This is a Piccolo podcast production.
Welcome to Adam Shand at Large. Can you believe it? It's 10 years since Mark Brandon Chopper Reed passed away. It's actually October 2013, so a few months out, but I find it hard to believe that it's been 10 years. I knew Mark Brandon Chopper Reed very well. I knew him more as Mark rather than Chopper because he was living this kind of alter ego for so long. It was interesting because when I started to write my book about him called The Real Chopper, people would say to me, you wouldn't say that to Mark if he was alive, tell the truth about him, that all his stuff was lies. And I said, well, in fact, that's what he wanted. In the last period of his life, he was trying to live in the truth. He spoke to Simone Ubaldi, a wonderful ghostwriter, for his last book called Road to Nowhere. And in there, he began to explode some of the myths. And she asked him questions that he'd never been asked before. And he answered them truthfully. So he'd been trapped in this Chopper Reed alter ego for all these years. But he still had an issue to deal with. He had no money. He actually told his first ghostwriter, John Sylvester, that he would die broke, he'd live broke, and that would be his end. But really, at the end, he realized he needed some money because he had a loving wife, Margaret, and his little boy, Roy, to look after. So this led to the topic of our episode today, which is Chopper Reed's greatest heist. And you've never heard about this one, and I guess, you know, just the way things go. But I assisted him with that. And I find myself fighting against the myth, even in this. I'll tell you why. Because in his final media appearance with 60 Minutes, about 16 days before he died, he jumped up and said, I've killed four people. And he was now going to confess about it. And from the very beginning, I knew this was just false. I knew it was false. He killed one person, Sammy the Turk Ozakam, back in 1987, outside Bojangles nightclub. He'd got off on self-defense. And he clearly had not done it. But here he was, at the end of his life, about to tell everyone that he was much worse than we ever thought he was. And I knew he wasn't so bad. It all started, we get a call from Mark, myself and his manager, Andrew Parisi, saying that he wanted to make some money for his wife and children. He had another boy in Tasmania, Charlie, born to his first wife, Mary Ann. Needed some money for them. So he was going to tell some stories. We said, what stories you got left, Mark? Is there anything that's actually true? He said, shut up, would you? I'm not going to do the Chopper Reed accent, by the way. That'd be horrendous. But he told us, no, he had some stories to tell. And there were going to be four murders. I said, what? Four murders? So Andrew Parisi and I agreed to meet him. We didn't want to talk about it on the phone because here we were discussing murders. We're squareheads. We're not criminals. We don't want to talk about murders on the phone and be drawn into some accomplished role within his murder plots. So we agreed to meet him in the Edinburgh Gardens, which is a big public place in the inner city, in the Fitzroy area, actually. And we met him there in this bandstand, and he shuffled up, and he was looking very crook. In fact, to me, he was on the way out, really. And I looked at him. He was so thin and emaciated, so far from that big, commanding personality and physical figure that he was, to the point where it looked like he was almost wearing the skin of Chopper Reed, that sort of tapestry of prison tattoos and scars and things like that. It wasn't him at all. And I realized he had been wearing this mantle for so long, and he'd earned a living from it. In fact, the funny thing about him is you've probably all seen the film Chopper starring Eric Banner. And Eric spent some time with Mark in Tasmania to kind of get his vocal mannerisms and so forth. But I think Eric created his own Chopper Reed. And for the last period of his life, Mark lived in to that Chopper Reed. So he was trapped in that. Anyway, so he summons us for this meeting about these crooks that he'd supposedly killed. And he told us he had four murders to talk about. We were shocked. I mean, really? He said that he'd killed Desmond Costello, a painter and docker, whose body had been found at the excavation for the Eastern Freeway. But that was 1971, when Mark was only just 16. Bit of an early start. And then he claimed to have killed a fellow called Isaacs, who'd killed a little boy heinously years before, cut him up with a jam tin lid and things like that. And Mark was going to tell us the story of how he killed this bloke Isaacs with in company with a fella called Mad Charlie Heglaji. And this had happened in D Division, apparently. And anyway, so that one. Then we had Sammy the Turk. He now changed his story from one of being self-defense to being one that he just simply shot Sammy the Turk right in the eye. Actually, side story, I met the person, the mortician, who prepared Sammy the Turk's body for the funeral. Remarkable. He talked about filling in, it's a bit macabre actually, sorry, filling in this big hole in Sammy's head where the shotgun blast had hit him. And he was very pleased with the job he'd done because it looked like nice and natural. Anyway, that's another aside. And then he also claimed to have killed Sidney Michael Collins, who was a Tasmanian biker, who I'm sure all fans of Chopper Reed would remember that Mark had shot him in the stomach for some ridiculous, no reason at all. Really, was they were sitting in a car outside of a residence and Mark just turned around and shot him in the stomach. So here we were, we had four murders. And we said, Mark, what do you want to do with these? He says, take them to 60 Minutes and get me $250,000. I said, you got to be dreaming. No way. $250,000 for this pack of lies? He said, shut up, go and do it. I said, all right. So Andrew and I went off to Channel 9 and they jumped on it. They thought it was amazing. I couldn't believe it. And they took a little bit off the price, but not much. We were just amazed. So here was Chopper Reed's greatest heist. Now, the only thing standing in the way of this great payday was the truth. To which I probably posed a rather large menace, because 60 Minutes producer said to me, well, would you mind checking some of these? I said, are you sure you want to check them? They said, yeah, of course we do. So I started with the first one, which was that man, Isaacs, in D Division in Pentridge. And I went to the coroner's file and I found his the file on his murder or his death, shall I say. And when I look at what Mark was about to say, which was that he and Mad Charlie had got into the cell with the connivance of a screw, a warder, and had bashed the hell out of this man. And you probably read it in his books numerous times, how he killed Isaacs, jumped on his head and choked him and stabbed him and did all kinds of things. And finally just hooked him up to the cell door by a sheet as if he'd killed himself. And anyway, I went to the coroner's file. There were the pictures. And there was not a mark on Isaacs, not a mark. So clearly he had died of natural causes. He'd hung himself. He could not live with the shame of what he'd done, and he wasn't getting out of there. And there was probably other offences that he was up for, which meant he would be retried eventually and he would never get out. So he took his own life. That wasn't a good start to verifying this murder. I went then to Mad Charlie's prison record. And it turned out, I think you know where I'm going with this, he wasn't even in Pentridge at the time. And then we had Mark. He wasn't in D Division at the time. He was in the young offenders area. So there's no way in the world he killed Isaacs. And I told 60 Minutes that. And they went, oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much. That's probably enough research. I said, what about the other three? I said, no, it's all right. We'll pay for them. Off we went. I was a bit shocked. Anyway, so I saw this interview get set up in one of the old divisions at Pentridge, which is now a bit of a tourist attraction. And he sat there and he told these stories without a shred of remorse, or he just coldly explained how he killed these people. I was having to suppress guffaws of laughter because it was so obviously rubbish, errant rubbish. But the 60 Minutes audience lapped it up. I thought it was the best thing they'd ever heard. Here was their favorite standover man and killer, who obviously took out the bad guys. That was the key element of Mark Chopper Reed, was that he always took out the bad guys, the people that we didn't like. So we tended to tolerate all this sort of stuff. Anyway, so it goes to air. It's the highest rating 60 Minutes of the year. Unbelievable. I sat there with my jaw hitting the floor. People loved it. They didn't question anything in it. So that was Mark Chopper Reed's greatest heist in his career. And here's a bloke that was completely contrary to everything he'd ever said. In his first book, he claimed to have killed 19 people, 19, and helped, assisted with many, many more. It was completely bizarre. Because he was never investigated for any of these murders. And here's the kicker. in those four murders that he was supposed to have done, that he said he'd done, he was never investigated. There was no police follow-up whatsoever. And that story continues to go on till this day. It's on YouTube, and it's had like about 7 million views. So 7 million views for the bullshit, and my little book called The Real Chopper, well, it's done okay, but really, it's a fart against thunder. You know, the truth here is the fart against thunder. That no one wants to, they want Mark Reed, the myth. I found that remarkable, really. It's funny because when I approached him about writing the book, this was the same day as he gave us these confessions in Edinburgh Gardens. He said to me, well, you're writing a book about me and I'll probably be dead by the time it's out. You could go and do a chopper read on me. And we both knew what that was. I could write whatever I wanted about him. He made this joke. He said, listen, you could have Mark Chopper Reed striding out of a gay massage parlor and nobody's going to know the difference. I said, well, that's true, but I don't think that's what I want to do. I want to drill into the person you were. And when you do go into his family background, you see this is a kid who was just looking for friends his whole life. He constructed these stories based on his childhood friends who became part of this gang in the streets of Paran, the Surrey Road Gang, apparently. And he had Cowboy Johnny Harris, Dave the Jew, Terry the Tank, and they were all these ruthless, merciless killers. And when I drilled into the stories, it was so far from that. These were just ordinary kids who were looking for fun, going to a recreational hall in Paran, and suddenly they find themselves being immortalized, or at least that's what you call it, in these writings. So he was looking for friends his whole life. And when you read his prison records, you realize nothing of the sort. A lot of the stories he told about the Overcoat Gang, about bashing this one, being involved in that one, it's all bullshit. It's all self-serving bullshit. But that's what people wanted. That's what people wanted. In fact, when I finished the book, which really drilled into all the true stories, which people didn't really want to hear, I have to say, I had this dream. Just when I was finishing the manuscript, I dreamt that I'd killed Chopper Reed and buried him in my front garden. And the whole amassed media, the ABC, Channel 9, a whole string of print journals were in my street yelling at the house, what have you done with Chopper Reed? You've killed Chopper. What's happened to Chopper? And they were outraged by the fact that I'd presented the truth about him when they preferred the myth. And I found myself having to escape through a side door to this angry mob because I'd killed Chopper Reed. I still feel a bit like that today because people do want the myth. They really do. It's hard to believe. He found a way to give us what we wanted. You know, he realized we needed a persona like this and he created it entirely. I remember the New York Times called him Australia's brand name for ferocity. Another TV host said he was a toothless monster without a vestige of social conscience. He took umbrage. He still had some teeth, he told me once. It was this ability to take down the unctuous and hypocrites with good humor that inspired enormous affection and loyalty from his readers. To me, Chopper Reed, he was a rogue, no doubt about that, but he never enjoyed enough success to be a real villain for the public. In fact, you probably heard his famous slogan, never plead guilty, always keep quiet, when the reverse was true. Whenever Mark was in a police station, he would talk his head off. He would open up like a watermelon falling off a truck. It was like his duty was not to let the police down, rather than to keep himself out of jail. And when you look at the 23 years he did in jail, it was all for stupid things where he was trying to what? Find a friend. His first stint in jail in Pentridge was where he had his mate Bernie. He was working on his poultry farm out in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne. They'd gone to a dance at Wandon and they saw one of the other mates was being roughed up by the bouncers. So Mark roars in there and begins to try to bash the bouncers. Of course, the bouncers are off-duty policemen who've all got batons in their pockets, and they give Mark a fearful beating and take him off to jail. He spends several months in there, so that's the first stint. He then gets involved with Mad Charlie Haglaji, which we've already talked about him. But Mad Charlie and him used to go to some massage parlors around St. Kilda and Paran area. And they went to one, and Mad Charlie goes with a girl that he thinks is a girl, but discovers halfway through that the boy is a man. So he gets upset and hits the sex worker with a bottle. Mark comes in to help as well and bashes a few people. They rob some takings from the massage parlor and off they go. And when you hear this in Mark's telling of the story, there's a wave of he and Mad Charlie were standing over all these massage parlors and brothels and so forth, and couldn't be anywhere further from the truth. I've spoken to people of that era who ran massage parlors, and guess what? They'd never heard of any of these exploits, and they would have known. In fact, if two young punks like Haglaji and Reed decided to walk across the threshold and stand over these people, they were very serious people. They would have been bashed and shot. That would have been the last we'd ever heard of them. So he ends up in Pentridge for that. He gets out after a while for that one. What does he do next? He decides that his mate Jimmy Lofton, who's gone to J Ward in Ararat, which is a mental ward for the insane prisoners, he wants to get him out of there. So how's he going to do it? He's going to kidnap a judge. What a great idea that was. So he tries to, he gets into the courtroom there, Judge Martin. He doesn't get anywhere near the judge himself. He's got a sawn-off shotgun in his coat and all this kind of stuff. He's gone to the Waterside Workers Hotel for a few drinks beforehand to summon up the stupidity to do what he was about to do. He doesn't get anywhere near the judge. The tip staff just grabs him and pushes him down. That's the end of it. Gets 14 years for that. 14 years. Not a good idea. And what to make matters worse, as you know from the film, how did Jimmy Lofton repay him? Stabbed him. That's what he did. Stabbed him. So good on you, mate. And that was the end of that. So he spends all this time and he ends up in H Division, which of course was the punishment division of Pentridge. And he quickly forms alliances, not with prisoners, but with the warders, because in reality, he loved to defer to authority. That's how he operated. His father had been a military man. He'd grown up with a father who actually said, if you don't obey me, I'm going to beat the crap out of you. And he gave him so many strappings as a youth. I think he was traumatized by it. The bullshitting actually began with the previous generation. Keith Reed, Mark's father, was a military man. He'd been up in New Guinea during the Second World War. And Mark told a range of stories, no doubt told to him by his father, that Keith had been a commando and that he'd been involved in the slaughtering of Japanese prisoners of war. He shot them all when they were having a bath in the ocean or, you know, all this sort of nonsense. You know, when I did the research, I actually got Keith Reed's military record. In fact, he was a dental technician, which is not to say he wasn't up at the front, because you needed dental technicians there. If people had facial wounds and things, they needed that sort of stuff, but he wasn't there fighting. And he certainly wasn't there executing prisoners. So the bullshit ran deep in the family. Let's say that. And when you look at his background, he was always deferring to authority. And there's lots of stories about Mark there bashing prisoners on behalf of warders, going into people's cells late at night at the behest of warders in order to sort people out. He became the warder's lag, as you might say. Now, this is my producer, Andrew Menzel. He's a bit of a Chopper fan, and I think I've just about told him that God doesn't exist.
I've got a couple of questions for you. You said you met Mark Chopper Reed. What was he like when you were in his presence?
Mark was intimidating simply because of his reputation. In person, he was a very soft individual, very, very sentimental, romantic. He loved his wife, Margaret, who really did so much for him. I've got to single her out. She did a fantastic job in keeping him alive, not just out of jail, but alive. So he was gregarious. He was full of one-liners, but he always wanted you to like him. And it's really in at odds with this rough, tough, aggressive, ruthless person. He was someone who always wanted to be liked, I think. And
why do we know about him? Why do we know about him? You know, you don't know about these hitmen, but for some reason, Mark Chopper Reed is, you know, notorious.
Yeah, well, see, what happens, and the key to Chopper's fame is being a storyteller. And in jail, the storytellers are the ones that become popular. And because people have nothing else to do but sit around and tell stories. And so Mark instinctively saw this, that this was an opportunity to survive in jail, to build his own reputation. And so he ruthlessly stole all the stories of his fellow inmates. And I remember Billy Longley, who was a famous gangster down here, he got pretty upset with Mark because there he was. Billy had been involved in a really nasty underworld war. Many people had died. He'd been shot at and nearly killed. He'd done a long time in jail, and hardly anybody knew him. There was Chopper Reed, who'd done one stupid thing after another, and the crowning glory, of course, being having his ears chopped off. And Billy tried to tell a story that he was involved in that too, but he wasn't. He claimed that one of the screws come up with a jam jar with Chopper's ears in them, and clearly that wasn't true. But so he was a self-made myth, and he also had the advantage. He reached out to John Sylvester, who is still a very senior crime writer in Victoria, and with this extraordinary manuscript from the inside. And it was, you just don't hear from prisoners inside like this. So he managed to get his story through pretty much unfiltered. I mean, from the first page, he's talking about his first murder, taking some person who tried to kill him and made him dig his own grave and was standing over him with a gun. And the guy made the mistake of looking away, and Chopper took out his legs with the shovel, and then buried this guy in the grave that was meant for Mark. And that was supposed to be at Mount Donna Boang. Well, no one's ever heard of a person disappearing. There's nobody there that anyone has ever bothered to look for, shall we say. So people didn't challenge it. I mean, and when you talk to people in the underworld, people in the wider world would say, oh, Chopper Reed is so fearsome. What a gangster. What, you know, how could, he's the top of the heap and all this type of stuff. But most people in the underworld had never heard of him. He was a jail phenomenon because he'd been there for 23 years, don't forget. He was a jail phenomenon who really had no gang. It wasn't a gangster. You've got to have a gang to be a gangster. So he was really a person that was play acting. In fact, one of his earliest friends was Bernie. Bernie is now an antique dealer. And in one or two of Mark's books, he's Bernie the Basher. Couldn't be anything further from the truth. Lovely, gentle man. But he talked about Mark, the things he did for friendship. Like, for instance, they were at Hollingsworth Academy. Mark was trying to finish his HSC or VC, as we call it down here in Victoria, and Bernie was there as well. And this particular rich girl had turned down Bernie for a date and was a bit upset. Bernie was upset about it. So what did Mark do? He bashed the girl. In fact, one of his books, he talks about how he impressed Bernie the Basher because he witnessed his first fight. But Mark didn't mention the fact that his opponent was a girl. So again, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. That's Chopper Reed's mentality.
I mean, people probably think, you know, just on reputation, you know, Chopper did a ton of hits. But, I mean, do you have any sort of idea? I mean, how many people did Chopper murder?
None. One. He was charged with the murder of Sammy the Turk Ozakam in 1987. But that was self-defense, and he gave himself up straight away. There was no hiding it. I mean, here's this thing, never plead guilty. That was one of the things later on. They would go to these country towns and do these shows with Mark Jackson, Roger Rogerson for a while, a few other people, different crims who came in and filled out the crew. And they would go to these country towns, and they would go to the local Bunnings, buy all these axes and picks and all these different things, and Mark would sign it always, never plead guilty, you know, stay free, you know, never help the cops, all rubbish, always help the cops. Always owned up, like he was proud of what he did. You know, he always, I mean, when he shot Sammy the Turk, it was to fulfill a lifelong dream of knowing what it was like to shoot somebody. He had shot one kid way back in the day, a guy called Johnny Corral or Coral, depending on how you pronounce it. And he was just some fool that they had a dispute with over the years. And he was with another guy who actually found, and they shot this bloke in the foot, and he was disabled the rest of his life. So, I mean, it was wanton, ruthless, pathetic stuff. There's no four murders and certainly not 19 murders. I mean, how do 19 people get murdered and no one knows who they are or where they are? That's just not possible.
And I'm guessing from what you're saying that the movie that was released in 2000, the year 2000, with Eric Bana playing Mark Chopper Reed, is not very accurate.
What you see in the Chopper film is what Mark created in From the Inside, his first book. And it does hang together. It's a great read, and he understood how to put a story together, and he understood how to put a character together. But the character you saw in there was far from the reality. There was Eric Banner's Chopper, who was always self-assured, in control of every situation, ruthless, violent. And the real Mark was sentimental. I think a sad character in many ways, really. A sad character. And so I think Eric Banner's Chopper became Mark Reed's Chopper. And there were some of the mannerisms that I saw in that film, which I saw Mark had taken on. Like, there's that classic one where he's saying to the kids, "Hello, the little kid, hello, hello, hello." That wasn't Mark. That was Eric Banner. So many things he'd adopted. And so, but it wasn't just him. There have been other people who've donned the Chopper Reed mantle. There's Heath Franklin as well. One or two other comedians have gone out there as Chopper Reed. So it's not as if it's an exclusive character to Mark. I remember sitting there once at his house watching Heath Franklin, who's done an amazing Chopper, and looking at himself being played by somebody else on the television, and he was completely bewildered. He said, "What can I do about this bloke? Nothing. He's stealing my livelihood." And that's what it was. Chopper Reed was a livelihood to Mark Reed. I mean, even the name Chopper, take all of his stories with a grain of salt.
Well, Adam, I have to say, Adam Shand at Large has started off in fine fashion. Last episode, we documented a UFO sighting with Munyati. This week, you're debunking the myths around Mark Chopper Reed.
I've got to tell you, I think I believe more in UFOs than most of Mark Reed's stories. And that's not to criticize him, because I think, like I say, at the end, he wanted people to know the truth because he made it available. He told Simone Ubaldi, who wrote The Road to Nowhere, he told me a lot of things. But he said, no one wants the truth. They'd rather the legend. When faced with the choice between the legend and the truth, always print the legend. Next week, we're staying in the 70s. We're going to be talking about Australia's greatest ever hitman, not Chopper Reed, but Christopher Dale Flannery. And again, I'm going to disappoint you. He wasn't as big a killer as you think. But stick with us, because the truth is always more valuable than the legend.